And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Holly Tucker to the program today. Dr. Tucker is a professor of Vanderbilt University in Italian and French, as well as in its medical school's Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society. She's the author of Blood Work, A Tale of Medicine and Murder in the Scientific Revolution, and Pregnant Fictions, Childbirth and the Fairy Tale in Early Modern France. Today we'll be talking about her most recent book, City of Light, City of Poison, Murder, Magic, and the First Police Chief of Paris, which is published by W.W. Norton. Holly, first thing off, I'm going to apologize for all the butchering of the French names coming up in our story here.
What? I'm sure you have great pronunciation.
I actually bought the audiobook to help me out a little bit, so give the credit to the person who read your audiobook for you.
Wow. You did your homework.
Now, your last book, Blood Work, was about the race to save lives experimenting with blood transfusions. And the new book is about ending lives with poison. Talk about going from extremes and human behavior.
I hadn't thought about it that way.
So how did the story of the affair of the poisons come to you as a topic?
You know, I actually thought that I would write this book before I wrote Blood Work because it's such a great story. I mean, anytime you have poisoners and witches and kings and mistresses and tortures and interrogations, the problem was I got worried that I wasn't going to have enough primary text to write it because as I started to do the research, I discovered as I opened the book with that Louis XIV was so nervous about this scandal getting out that he asked that all of the most incriminating documents be put under seal for time eternal. And when the last person, except the king, died, Louis XIV was the last one who knew these secrets. He requested that the documents be brought to him. And then on a hot day in July, he fed each of the most incriminating manuscript pages into the fire. And so when I discovered that, I thought, goodness, I can't write a book about this. It's a juicy story, but how can I write a book when half of the story is missing? So I turned my attention to another case of poisoning, which was the poisoning of the first blood transfusion patient in Paris in the 1670s. Then it was only after Blood Work came out and I just kept thinking about my next project. I pitched a couple of nonfiction books to my agent and my editor, and each time my heart wanted to tell this story. So I went back and started diving through the documents again in Paris, and there are thousands, I'm not kidding you, thousands of pages in bound manuscript volumes. And then it was when I started to dig through some more that I discovered that the police chief who had done all the investigations was meticulous. And when he was asked by the king, Louis XIV, to put those documents aside and put them under seal, he took a detailed inventory and he made detailed notes and detailed summaries of the documents as well as his own thoughts about the documents. That in itself was a 900-page manuscript, but then I knew that I had plenty I could be working with.
You said in your acknowledgments that you use some high-tech software to help you kind of go through all these documents. What's that software and how did it assist you in all this research?
Well, anytime you have so many primary documents, and, you know, we're talking about court records, interrogation records, torture records, as well as other accounts, whether they're letters or journals or memoirs, all of these different stories both link up to one another and they also contradict each other. So there's a program that social scientists who do qualitative research use called InVivo. And what InVivo allowed me to do once I was able to, for the most important records, get those transcribed, they're all in French, transcribed and uploaded into this program, I could then do a process that's called coding, qualitative coding, where most people would just do keyword searches in a document. What I would be able to do is to mark up documents down to the cases that they were being referred to, the locations, the time, the suspects, whether who was authoring the document and that who was being interrogated or who was testifying, and the persons about whom they were testifying. And then I could run from there all different types of reports that would allow me to create, I mean, even visual links that would allow me to create visual links to see where things overlapped. And, you know, there's some small details, like in a record that, you know, somebody was interrogated in, they might mention that they were on this given street at that given time and they saw an accused criminal A, right? So what I could do is I could take a look at criminal A's testimony and be able to see if at any point they talk about being on that street and if they give me an idea about what time they were. And that might be overlooked. It could be entirely overlooked given just the sheer amount of evidence that I was sifting through. As I understand it, increasingly lawyers are also using that in going through their evidence as they're putting together cases.
Now, with the French Academy having more control over the language than the scattershot way we approach English, is the French language more consistent from 350 years ago than English was from 350 years ago?
It's a mess. It's just as much of a mess. So we're talking about the 17th century. Spelling doesn't really become consistent until after the French Revolution, after the 18th century, right? And so you have all different types of spelling changes. In fact, for anybody who knows a little bit about French, or if anybody's even taken one semester of high school French, the things that dog students most are those accents. Have you ever taken French?
No, but I know about, was it the grave and
the grave, the aigu, the circumflex, right? Actually, what fascinates me, the reason why we have those is because they needed to mark where, okay, sometimes they also give an indication of pronunciation in French, but those are leftovers from the 17th and 18th century where extra letters were pulled out. So that in French, forêt, F-O-R-E with a hat, circumflex T, that hat over the T has nothing to do with how you pronounce that word, but it's because in the late 17th, early 18th century, they pulled out an S. And that makes it look an awful lot like English, makes it look like forest, right? And the reason why they did that was because typographers, when they were loading up the different letters for the printing press, it was a lot easier to put forêt with a hat than forêt with an S, right? And so it was a way to save space in paper. To get back to your question, was it consistent? Not at all. And then add to the fact that you have all different people, all different kinds of people writing, from notaries to police officers to the police chief himself to people writing letters to the poisoners requesting their services. I had all different types of hands that I was working with, and some hands were more educated, more literate than others. But it was also really neat because when I got into the manuscripts, each time a person was interrogated, they were read back their testimony and they had to sign or initial each page of testimony. And that was fascinating because I could see there's one very colorful guy. I think you remember him, Le Sage, who is partnered with the main midwife, abortionist, herbalist, witch, Catherine Voisin. And he has this unbelievably looping handwriting. There's actually a reproduction of it in the book. And then there are some women who are clearly scared out of their minds, where the hand, you can see that their initials are shaking. And then others don't know how to read. And so they just simply mark an X to indicate that they've heard their testimony and that they've had a chance to review it.
Well, and you mentioned that word that comes to have such a different meaning in this context, question. Why would someone be more afraid of a question back then than they are now?
Well, a question was not a question. A question was what they called torture. And in France, it was really interesting. We often think of, you know, the horrible practice of torture as a way to get secrets out of somebody before any type of judgment might occur, right? In this case, there could be no torturing until the person had actually been convicted. So after a person was convicted, they would be swept away, usually to the Bastille prison. And then depending on the extent of their crimes, the hideousness of their crimes, and the information to which they might be privy, they would have first the preliminary question, in which they would just scare the heck out of them and show them the buckets of water that they were going to force down their throats, or show them the torture boots that they would use. They took pieces of wood that they would wrap around a person's leg and tie it tight, either with a leather strap or sometimes metal. And then at different moments, they would take a shim and hammer the shim into that, breaking the bones. They would show them perhaps the rack. And that oftentimes was enough to get the person to implicate other people or tell them more things about other circumstances that didn't have anything directly relevant to the accused, well, convicted criminal's case. And then there was the extraordinary question. in which people were pretty much depending, well, always, no matter what the form, whether it was through water, the strapado, which are the torture boots, or the rack, they would usually be taken right to the point of severe pain, to the point of dying almost, but just enough so that they could survive long enough to be executed.
In this case, it's mostly criminal culpability they're trying to punish here. But like an auto da fe back in the Spanish Inquisition, weird religious things come into it pretty late into the game with the accusation of witchcraft and such.
Mm-hmm. The stories, as the police chief begins to, I mean, to back up just a moment, he ended up arresting over 400 people accused or implicated in some way, shape, or form in a network of poisoners, and later he discovers witches and rogue priests. And for your readers and listeners, this is all true. Keep in mind, this is what is crazy. He arrested over 400 people. 200 people were tried in a secret tribunal so that their stories and also just the scandal that they were associated with could be kept out of the public eye. And over 30 people were executed, and still more were tortured. What's interesting is when the police chief begins these investigations, he really doesn't know just how deep it goes. He thinks he's dealing with actually, you know, a network of midwives who are performing lots of abortions in a neighborhood really not that far from the Louvre. I've walked that many times, maybe not even 10 minutes walking from the Louvre. And with each interrogation, he discovers that, you know, not only are they providing abortions, they're selling poisons, they're selling love potions, and the clients are getting more and more noble in that there seemed to be very little difference between the neighborhood where these abortionist witches, midwives worked, and then also the king's palace itself.
Now, for the title of the book, City of Light, City of Poison, this is the time in which Paris would get its nickname. So how did it finally get the nickname City of Light?
Yeah, you know, I had always imagined, you know, Paris, the city of enlightenment. I'm thinking about the 18th century enlightenment philosophers, thinking that's where this came up.
Voltaire and Rousseau. Yeah,
exactly. It turns out it's much earlier. It gets its name between 1667 and the early 1670s. Nicolas de la Reynie, that's the name of the police chief. I notice you haven't spoken French yet.
I'm saving it up.
Nicolas de la Reynie is the police chief, and he is named to that role. He's the first police chief of Paris because the city was an embarrassment to Louis XIV. It was dark, it was dirty, it was dangerous. And Louis XIV, of course, is wanting to make his name in Europe, is the great divine king. And he really can't do that when he has Paris, which is something like an armpit. So the first thing that La Reynie does is he cleans up the street. The mud often could be over ankle deep, disgusting chamber pot slop and
horse effluvia.
Oh, all different types of things. And on butchering days, that was the worst because, you know, you had congealed blood that people would be tromping through. It was, I wouldn't ever want to go back to 17th century Paris, but it was also really dark. The only light that could be found at night, which was the case for all European cities, was, you know, maybe a glimmer through the drapes of one of the homes that you go past. And La Reynie decided that if he was going to fight crime, because there were lots of handgun murders, guns had gotten shorter and smaller and easier to conceal, as well as stabbing deaths, you needed to put light in a city so that people could see around the corner. So he devises a system in which these huge candles that he had specially designed would be put in to even larger lanterns that he also had specially designed that would be hoisted up onto the sides of the buildings. And every day at dusk, the church bells would ring and a whole army of people and all the neighbors would hoist the lanterns up. And within a year, I think he had something like over 2,600 lanterns installed. It was a really remarkable feat. And so Paris ended up becoming, you know, the city that these tourists wanted to go to because they just couldn't believe how gorgeous it was with all these lights at night. Now, La Reynie claimed that it was also, the streets were also so clean that the horses were slipping around. And I don't believe that.
He tragically lost his family early on in his marriage. Do you think that loss is one of the things that led him to throw himself into his work so hard?
You know, you're one of the first people to ask that question, and thank you. I've tried really hard to get an idea of how this guy ticks. And it's true. He met and married his first wife. And the little that we know, again, this is nonfiction, so I can't embellish anything. The little that we know is that it was one of those odd marriages that was a marriage of love. And his wife ended up dying very early in childbirth during their first years of their marriage. And it would take another 30 years for him to decide to remarry.
And he was basically told to remarry, wasn't
he? I think
he
pretty much he was told to remarry. That's another thing I hadn't really thought about before, Stephen, is that even if he is a bit older, you can't have this bachelor trying to run the city, especially at a time when Louis XIV was trying to impose greater morals. And also La Renée was going to be sniffing out, I don't talk much about this, but he was deeply involved in breaking up prostitution rings as well. And you certainly didn't want, you know, an eligible bachelor batching it around Paris. And so he did end up marrying, and he ended up marrying, you know, a very wealthy woman who was part of the legal empire, if you will, at the time. And she really doesn't show up at all. He's so busy with his job. She only shows up, as far as I can tell, in all the research that I did about on him, she shows up in the story the day after his death. And also in his will, he has all of these papers, as you can imagine. I mean, he's working from a compound in Paris, his personal home, which is huge because now he can afford it because he's married into a very nice family. He explains to his wife, Gabrielle, that, you know, on my death, you're responsible for making sure that these papers are taken care of the way I want them to be taken care of. And so he prepares a letter to the king that has a key that gives the king access to all the documents under seal. And the only time Gabrielle really shows up in this story is when she makes sure the day after her husband dies is that letter gets to Versailles. It was frustrating to me because I'd imagined, you know, this really neat opening scene in which actually I wrote it this way because I knew that she'd been there. She'd been the one who made sure that the guards got the letter, that, you know, the guards would show up to Nicolas de la Reynie's house and get the letter from Gabrielle, and then they would go to Versailles. And it's interesting, one of my beta readers is my mother, and my mother was just so struck by Gabrielle. She was trying to figure out what it would be like to be a widow to this police chief. She goes, I want to know more about Gabrielle. And I had to tell her, I'm really sorry, I don't know anything about her. So eventually Gabrielle just got cut out of the book.
Wasn't Gabrielle the men's version his given name?
Mm-hmm.
De la Reynie's?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So it's weird.
Weird. Gabrielle and Gabrielle.
Mm-hmm. Like Stephen and Stephanie.
There you go.
A woman named Stephanie. Now, one of his duties was to regulate the production of theriac.
Mm.
What is theriac?
C'est bien. Theriac?
Merci beaucoup.
Theriac is actually something of a cure-all, and it was specifically intended as an antidote to poison. And as the news of the first poisoning death started to make its way through Paris, all the apothecaries were trying to sell their, I guess it would sort of be the equivalent of a 17th century ibuprofen, right? You just have it handy, just in case. So there's one apothecary who has strong royal connections who decides, Charas is the name, Charas, who invites La Renée to witness the production of his special version of theriac. You read in the book, I think, it is a production, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
How many ingredients? Something like over 39 ingredients from all corners of the earth. Each ingredient sounding more and more exotic than the other. I came across other recipes by other apothecaries that they would claim that they would use, for example, ground mummy powder. Mummies were actually prized, so people would go to like Egypt, claimed to have gone to Egypt to uncover these mummies because they had some sort of curative powder. And so what Charas does is he mixes this a whole, I think it's like something like 200 pounds worth of theriac that he also, of course, you know, like cures like in the early modern period. So, yeah, there's a fair bit of viper venom and snake skin and you name it. He got the prize that he was looking for. La Renée was sufficiently impressed to give his blessing to it, saying, I witnessed this and it is of the finest quality, which the apothecary promptly posted in his window and became an overnight celebrity. Everybody wanted his theriac.
And it seems, you know, as we mentioned, this is pre-Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. So this is more based on wishful thinking than any scientific processes.
I'd like to think so. In fact, we know so. Poison and antidotes have always been a fascination in history. I think about Mithridates. Mithridates is an ancient king who was so afraid that he would be poisoned that he poisoned his own court members and would have them drug off so that he could test the latest try at in an antidote. And then, of course, there's the Borgias. The fact is nobody really knew what poisons were being used. So if you're not even sure what's being used, how can you combat it? Arsenic was the poison of choice. It was odorless, colorless, tasteless, but there were no tests for arsenic until the 19th century. Other types of mixtures would be Spanish fly, crushed up iridescent beetles that were usually used for aphrodisiacs, but if taken in large enough quantities, made people sick, and it could make you so sick that it would kill you, right? And of course, you know, toad venom and snake venom, you name it, how can you fight it if you don't know really what poison's being used?
I think the poisoners would have to have a better success rate than the antidote providers, because you can always just say, oh, it's a different type of poison, but you got to get results if you're killing somebody.
And now that I think about it, Stephen, I can't think of a single case that I ran into where an antidote worked. Quite honestly.
And if they did, was it just as a coincidence that there wasn't enough of the poison to kill the person that happened to survive? That it was correlation.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Well, and one of the things that's so interesting as well, you couldn't even be sure that you'd been poisoned when in fact you had been poisoned. In some of the cases in which women were trying to get rid of their husbands, there was a canny way of poisoning. What they would do is they would send their husband's clothing off to the laundress who happened to have access to arsenic, who would sprinkle it into the husband's pants. And over time, the husband would get a skin infection that would then leak into his body. And so by the time he died, the wife was able to say, I'm so upset that my husband died, but I am so glad because he was a philandering infidel.
Now, poisoning fever really gets underway with the Marquise Brinvilliers, mm-hmm. and she was a very determined poisoner.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so she, in 1665-1666, decided that she was going to poison her father, primarily because her father was not that happy with her choice of lover. So she would bring with her this red case, and then under the guise of saying, Father, let me help you, you're feeling weak. He was feeling weak because she was giving him small enough doses of poison to make him sick. Eventually, she bumped him off. And then later on, she had a row with her two brothers, and off you go. All three of them died at her hands by poison.
Around the same time, there was a suspicious death in the royal court. Mm. And Louis XIV's brother's wife dies under mysterious circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Louis XIV had lots of mistresses. He had lots
of... How many
of
did he have?
Oh, that would be hard to say. But I can tell you there were at least, so let me count them, 1, 2, 3, I think 5 main ones who were close enough to be able to get a chateau out of them in the end. I think that was the way that you could tell. If you were just sort of fling, then...
And maybe get your kids legitimized.
Yeah, if you're really special to him. But he had a very close relationship with Henrietta Anne, who was the daughter of Charles II, the English king who was beheaded. Her mother and Henrietta Anne fled to France and were actually cousins to Louis XIV. They're all interrelated, right? Europe is, in the end, very small. Everybody knows everybody in the monarchies, and everybody's interrelated. Louis XIV, his mother said, why don't you marry her? He didn't want anything to do with her. But as soon as she started getting more beautiful, then they became good companions. But as the court was getting suspicious of these two lovers, they decided to do a great ruse. Louis XIV married off Henrietta Anne to his brother, Philippe. His brother Philippe is one of those people you'd never want to have at a dinner party. He just is sort of snarly. He's always unhappy. He's always looking to see what other people get. And I think a lot of it was because, can you imagine being Louis XIV's brother? Can you imagine being the Sun King's brother? And then could you imagine that you actually get your brother's cast off? You get the woman that your brother would have thought about wanting to marry. And so add to it that he wasn't really all that fond of women. He himself also had a number of male lovers. And so his wife, Henrietta Anne, becomes ill. And what I've noticed in a lot of these poisonings is they often have gastric problems. That usually seems to herald something's not right. Like you said, she dies under suspicious circumstances, but not until after she leads members of their court to suggest that maybe her husband had it out for her.
Now, you mentioned earlier that Louis was trying to raise the moral profile of the country, but of course his own personal failings when it came to monogamy.
And gambling. And let's see, everything else you can imagine. What was good for his people absolutely was not good for him.
So we understand how we can lie to ourselves, but how does one lie to the people to cover up the king's indiscretions? Did the public at large know that he was a philanderer?
Of course they did. It was something of a spectator sport, right? Because over time, Louis didn't mask the fact that he had a wife and he had what they call a mistress in title. So where his wife, Maria Theresa, went, so did his highest ranking lover. Also, he would make these ridiculous attempts to hide the fact that his lovers were pregnant, and so would the mistresses. There's some really sad stories where his main mistresses got pregnant often, and you have to at least pretend. You have to make this strange ruse. Athénaïs de Montespan. Try that one. Athénaïs. Ah, it's not bad.
De Montespan.
Athénaïs was one of his longest lasting mistresses. And each time she got pregnant, she wore a dress that would cut right underneath her breast and cover up her stomach. Because this is the time that normally you'd wear corsets, right? And Louis XIV and Athénaïs and the rest of the court members tried to pass that off as the latest fashion, as that's just what you're supposed to wear, when everybody knew that she was pregnant. So all of this, yes, he tried to cover it up, but he didn't try to cover it up. And pretty much all of France knew the secrets that weren't so secret.
There's going to be all sorts of court and palace intrigue, people fighting for favor with the king. Can you give us a real quick look at Colbert and Louvois?
Well, I'm intrigued by this because I'm intrigued by the intrigue. Louis XIV really loved to pit his ministers against each other. So Jean-Baptiste Colbert, not the TV host, but Colbert, basically, he was the Minister of the Interior. So he was very interested in bridges and buildings and spaces and towns in France. And Louis XIV's Minister of War, Louvois, of course, wanted to make war. And the two of them were angling for Louis XIV's attention at all times. Louvois was much younger than Colbert, which really rankled Colbert. And the question was, where would the king put his energies? Would he try to make Paris, especially Paris, a gem? Or would he take that money and try to expand out his territories into what's now Belgium and into the Netherlands?
The Low Countries.
The Low Countries, which were occupied in large part by the Spanish, who had long been at war with Louis. And in the end, Louvois triumphed. We do get a lot of beautiful buildings in Paris from the 17th century, but most of the efforts were put in war abroad. And then also Louis sunk tons of money into Versailles, which is under construction at the same time period.
And it was ironic later on that all of this intrigue with the affair of the poisons would work against his ambitions, because exiling a woman whose son became Eugene of Savoy, who was a great Austrian warrior.
You know, all of it's very linked to this. And I don't think Louis XIV could have imagined how this would end up playing out. He told his police chief, I need you to find out the truth and pursue this without concern to rank or privilege, which is exactly what he ordered. And of course, Nicolas de Larigny did that and did that well. But as soon as things started getting close, the king went, oops. Other things too, he really didn't anticipate just how canny the police chief would be, because to be able to do this, the police chief needed to be able to get access to some people that the king would not want him to be able to have access to, right? Colbert wasn't into La Reynie pursuing this. La Reynie, he reported to Colbert. Eventually, La Reynie said, this is ridiculous. I need to get more traction here. So I'm going to go to the person who has the king's ear. And that was Louvois. Louvois had plenty of other axes to grind himself. So Louvois was able to use the affair of the poisons. So La Reynie would hear from Louvois that one of these noblemen should be interrogated, and then Louvois would tell the king, by the way, I think we've got something onto this nobleman. It was really, oh, gosh, you think House of Cards is is mean and quite nasty. This was even worse, and I think that Louis XIV, in the end, as you said, just didn't imagine how far it could go.
A phrase that controls the entire book. If we go back to the time of Marquise Brinvilliers, mm-hmm. Sevigny wrote, "And so it is, Brinvilliers is in the air after she was executed. We will now breathe her, and with this she will turn us into poisoners."
I love that quote. I love that quote. The Marquise of Sevigny shows up a lot, not as a character in the book, but rather as this frank, clear-eyed commentary of what's happening. She wrote lots of letters to her daughter, and she represents, in a way, and we still have those letters, she represents in many ways the eyes and the ears and the heart of how the nobility were responding to this. They went from both fascination, I mean, Sevigny was there and witnessed Brinvilliers' execution, to absolute sheer terror that they could be next.
Do you think people started behaving more kindly at this time with in anticipation of something being slipped into their food?
Well, you know, we have documentation as, you know, people saying, gosh, I can't trust anybody, not my kids, not my wife. I think that this scandal, the affair of the poisons, which lasted, let's see, from 1670 to 1680, I think that it sparked pure panic. Whether it was well-placed or not, everyone in Europe was afraid of being poisoned.
Now, we're running short on time, but we have to introduce a pure villainous type character, and that is Madame Voisin.
Oh, she's scary, isn't she?
Oh, she is a handful.
She is a handful, yes. She basically held court in this area. Oh, here's one, Montorgueil.
That one,
you're a wise man. In the Montorgueil area, which is, again, just outside of 10 minutes from the Louvre. And she had this whole network of people and, you know,
the Court of Miracles.
The Court of Miracles was just down the street from her house. And you could always count on the crime bosses there having anywhere from 100 to 500 people who lived nearby who would show up in the morning and then fan out into the city with all different types of infirmities. And they called it the Court of Miracles because after a day of begging and earning lots of money, they would come back to the den and they would give a pretty generous portion of their earnings, and then they would be miraculously cured. A blind man could suddenly see, and somebody who couldn't walk without crutches could suddenly dance. That was the neighborhood that Voisin lived in. And what is quite horrific, she had this courtyard in which she would abort babies. By some account, over thousands of babies were aborted there. The person I feel most intrigued and sad about is her daughter, Marie Marguerite. She witnessed all of this, and she comes into the story at different occasions because we have a document of what she recounted to La Reynie, the police chief, about her childhood. She was forced from a very young age to do errands for her mother, to go get pigeons that they could slaughter then for their magical ceremonies, to do errands, to deliver poisons to nobility out at their different chateaus. And the thing that is unsettling to me is her accounts of child sacrifices that may or may not have taken place at her mother's house. This woman was wicked to the core. And I think that La Reynie, in taking the police chief position, had no idea just how deeply he was going to have to stare into these dark souls. And in the end, I believe it really did change him.
But one of the strangest things of that investigation was they never interviewed her husband.
Yes. You know, this is a work of nonfiction. So I really, you know, this is why it took 4 years to write, because the archival record was just so big and all of the accounts were so complicated and contradictory. And there are still a lot of questions that I can't answer. And one of them is, why didn't they bring the husband in for questioning? This is Catherine Voisin's husband. He saw all this too. And then also, isn't it strange that not long after his wife was brought to prison, that he was mysteriously dead? How did that happen? There are just way too many questions that I can't answer. And so I save some of those speculations for the epilogue in the hopes that maybe readers will help speculate with me and then we can fill in the gaps.
Well, Holly, I'm sorry we're out of time for today. I could talk to you for another 30, 40 minutes about this book, but I want to thank you for making me look at every bite of food I take with a little bit more suspicion.
Well, here's one for you. Bon appétit.
Oh, merci. Holly Tucker is the author of City of Light, City of Poison, Murder, Magic, and the First Police Chief of Paris, which is published by W.W. Norton. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.